And now I'll read from the very end of the book. I'd like to try something a little bit different because we're all used to how these readings go. So since you're a captive audience, I've got you in this room. You're not going to run away. I'll do something a little bit different. And what I'm going to do is, for about 90 seconds, I'm going to play you a little bit of music that leads into the piece that I'd like to read. Basically, in the final chapter of the book, Julius, the narrator, goes to Carnegie Hall, and he goes to a performance by the Berlin Philharmonic, and they're playing Mahler's Ninth Symphony. So we'll start with just about a minute and a half of that, and then go into the passage. The first movement of the Ninth Symphony is like a great ship slipping out of port, weighty but nevertheless entirely graceful in its motion. In Rattle's hands, it began with sighs, a series of hesitations, a repeated falling figure that stretched out at the same time that it became more frenzied. I was listening, as always, both with my mind and with my body, entering into the familiar details of the music, discovering new details in the score, points of emphasis and articulation that I had not noticed before, or that had been brought forward for the first time by the conductor. Rattle, as I watched, was conducting Mahler, but he was also communicating, at least to me, as a longtime partisan of that music, with other performers of the same, Benjamin Zander, Yasha Horenstein, Claudio Abbado, John Barbirolli, Bernard Haitink, Leonard Bernstein, Hermann Scherchen, Otto Klemperer, and not least Bruno Walter, who had premiered the piece in Vienna a year before Mahler's death and 2 years before the beginning of the First World War. These were the names of mostly European men, many of them now dead, names that had in the 15 years since I came to the United States come to mean so much to me, each name connected to a specific mood and inflection, balanced, extreme, sentimental, pained, consoling, on the symphony's vast score. Simon Rattle, as he shaped the sound of the first two movements, guiding the orchestra through the frenzies and the lullabies, was staking his claim as one of the titans in this piece. The third movement, the rondo, was loud, rude, and as burlesque as it could conceivably be. Then out of a calmness that seemed to have all in the auditorium holding their breaths, the sweet hymn-like opening of the final movement, carried by the string instruments, filled the hall. I was stunned. I had never before noticed how similar the melody in this movement was to Abide With Me. And that revelation steeped me in the deep sorrow of Mahler's long but radiant elegy, and I felt I could also detect the intense concentration, the hundreds of private thoughts of the people in the auditorium with me. How strange it was that almost 100 years ago, right there in Manhattan, just a short walk away from Carnegie Hall, at the Plaza Hotel, on the corner of 59th Street and 5th Avenue, Mahler had been at work on this very symphony, aware of the heart condition that would soon take his life. In the glow of the final movement, but well before the music ended, an elderly woman in the front row stood and began to walk up the aisle. She walked slowly, and all eyes were on her, though all ears remained on the music. It was as though she had been summoned and was leaving into death, drawn by a force invisible to us. The old woman was frail, with a thin crown of white hair that, backlit by the stage, became a halo, and she moved so slowly that she was like a mote suspended inside the slow-moving music. One of her arms was slightly raised, as though she were being led forward by a helper, as though I was down there with my Oma, and the sweep of the music was pushing us gently forward as I escorted her out into the darkness. As she drifted to the entrance and out of sight, in her gracefulness, she resembled nothing so much as a boat departing on a country lake early in the morning, which, to those still standing on the shore, appears not to sail, but to dissolve into the substance of the fog. Mahler had worked without self-pity, through his illness, through the catalogue's sufferings, and in his gargantuan compositions had worked elegy finely into elegy. He liked to say, with characteristic gallows humor, that Krankheit ist Talentlosigkeit, illness is a lack of talent. He made his own death matter. There was one of his great talents, so that it almost seemed as though he really died like a dragon breaking down a wall, as is said of certain great Chinese poets. His funeral was to be in Vienna, in Grinzing Cemetery. And so, after he'd gotten the definitive sentence of death, a streptococcal blood infection, secondary to an earlier diagnosis of infective endocarditis, he had undertaken the arduous final journey home. He'd gone first by boat from New York to Paris, where he unsuccessfully tried an experimental serum at the Institut Pasteur, then by train, in great discomfort, to Vienna, where the crowds welcomed and extolled him, whom before they had treated so cruelly, following his motorcade as though he were Virgil returning to Rome to die. And die he did, a week later, at midnight on the 18th of May, 1911. The music stopped. Perfect silence in the hall. Simon Rattle was stock still on the podium, his baton still in the air, and the musicians, too, were still, their instruments up. I looked around the hall at the illuminated faces, all flooded with that silence. The seconds stretched on. No one coughed and no one moved. We could hear the faint sound of traffic in the far distance outside the hall, but inside it, not a sound. Even the hundreds of racing thoughts had stopped. Then Rattle brought his hands down, and the auditorium exploded with applause.